But we just left there, protested Zaphod. We left there and came to the restaurant at the end of the universe. Yes, sir, said the waiter, feeling that he was now into the home stretch and running well. The one was constructed on the ruins of the other. Oh, said Arthur brightly. You mean we've travelled in time, but not in space? Listen, you semi-evolved simian, cut in Zaphod. Go climb a tree, will you? Arthur bristled. Go bang your heads together, four eyes, he advised Zaphod. No, no, the waiter said to Zaphod. Your monkey has got it right, sir. Arthur stuttered in fury and said nothing apposite or indeed coherent. You jumped forward, I believe, 576,000,000,000 years, while staying in exactly the same place, explained the waiter. He smiled. He had a wonderful feeling that he'd finally won through against what seemed to be insuperable odds. That's it, said Zaphod. I got it. I told the computer to send us to the nearest place to eat. That's exactly what it did. Give or take 576,000,000,000 years or whatever, we never moved. Neat. They all agreed that this is very neat. But who, said Zaphod, is the cat on the phone? Whatever happened to Marvin, said Trillian. Zaphod clapped his hands to his head. The paranoid android! I left him moping about on Frogstar B. When was this? Well, 576,000,000,000 years ago, I suppose, said Zaphod. Hey, hand me the rat rod plate, Captain. The little waiter's eyebrows wandered about his forehead in confusion. I beg your pardon, sir? The phone, waiter, said Zaphod, grabbing it off him. Shee, you guys are so unhip, it's a wonder your bums don't fall off. Indeed, sir. Hey, Marvin, is that you? Said Zaphod into the phone. How are you doing, kid? There was a long pause before a thin, low voice came up the line.
I think you ought to know I'm feeling very depressed, it said.
Zaphod cupped his hand over the phone. It's Marvin, he said. Hey, Marvin, he said into the phone again. We're having a great time. Food, wine, a little personal abuse, and the universe going foom. Where can we find you? Again the pause.
You don't have to pretend to be interested in me, you know,
said Marvin at last.
I know perfectly well I'm only a menial robot.
Okay, okay, said Zaphod, but where are you?
Reverse primary thrust, Marvin. That's what they say to me. Open airlock number 3, Marvin. Marvin, can you pick up that piece of paper? Can I pick up that piece of paper? Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they ask me to...
Yeah, yeah, sympathized Zaphod hardly at all.
But I'm quite used to being humiliated,
droned Marvin.
I can even go and stick my head in a bucket of water, if you like. Would you like me to go and stick my head in a bucket of water? I've got one ready. Wait a minute.
Hey, Marvin, interrupted Zaphod, but it was too late. Sad little clunks and gurgles came up the line. What's he saying, asked Trillian. Nothing, said Zaphod. He just phoned up to wash his head at us.
There,
said Marvin, coming back on the line and bubbling a bit.
I hope that gave satisfaction.
Yeah, said Zaphod. Now, will you please tell us where you are?
I'm in the car park,
said Marvin. The car park? Said Zaphod. What are you doing there?
Parking cars. What else does one do in a car park?
Okay, hang in there. We'll be right down. In one movement, Zaphod leapt to his feet, threw down the phone and wrote Hot Black Desiato on the bill. Come on, guys, he said. Marvin's in the car park. Let's get on down. What's he doing in the car park? Said Arthur. Parking cars. What else, dum-dum? But what about the end of the universe? We'll miss the big moment. I've seen it. It's rubbish, said Zaphod. Nothing but a gnab gib. A what? Opposite of a big bang. Come on, let's get zappy. Few of the other diners paid them any attention as they weaved their way through the restaurant to the exit. Their eyes were riveted on the horror of the skies. An interesting effect to watch for, Max was telling them, is in the upper left-hand quadrant of the sky, where if you look very carefully, you'll see the star system Hastramel boiling away into the ultraviolet. Anyone here from Hastramel? There are one or two slightly hesitant cheers from somewhere at the back. Well, said Max, beaming cheerfully at them, it's too late to worry about whether you left the gas on now. Chapter 18. The main reception foyer was almost empty, but Ford nevertheless weaved his way through it. Zaphod grasped him firmly by the arm and manoeuvred him into a cubicle standing to one side of the entrance hall. What are you doing to him? Asked Arthur.
Sobering him up, said Zaphod, and pushed a coin into a slot. Lights flashed, gases swirled.
Hi, said Ford, stepping out a moment later. Where are we going?
Down to the car park, come on.
What about the personnel time teleport, said Ford. Get us straight back to the Heart of Gold.
Yeah, but I've cooled on that ship. Zani Whip can have it. I don't want to play his games. Let's see what we can find. A Sirius Cybernetics Corporation happy vertical people transporter took them down deep into the substrata beneath the restaurant. They were glad to see it had been vandalized and didn't try to make them happy as well as take them down. At the bottom of the shaft, the lift doors opened and a blast of cold, stale air hit them. The first thing they saw on leaving the lift was a long concrete wall with over 50 doors in it, offering lavatory facilities for all of 50 major life forms. Nevertheless, like every car park in the galaxy, throughout the entire history of car parks, this car park smelt predominantly of impatience. They turned a corner and found themselves on a moving catwalk that traversed a vast cavernous space that stretched off into the dim distance. It was divided off into bays, each of which contained a spaceship belonging to one of the diners upstairs, some smallish and utilitarian mass-production models, others vast shining limo ships, the playthings of the very rich. Seyfod's eyes sparkled with something that may or may not have been avarice as he passed over them. In fact, it's best to be clear on this point. Avarice is definitely what it was. "There he is," said Trillian. "Marvin, down there." They looked where she was pointing. Dimly they could see a small metal figure listlessly rubbing a small rag on one remote corner of a giant silver sun cruiser. At short intervals along the moving catwalk, wide transparent tubes led down to the floor level. Seyfod stepped off the catwalk into one of these and floated gently downwards. The others followed. Thinking back to this later, Arthur thought it was the single most enjoyable experience of his travels in the galaxy. "Hey, Marvin," said Seyfod, striding over towards him. "Hey, kid, are we pleased to see you?" Marvin turned, and insofar as it is possible for a totally inert metal face to look reproachful, this is what it did.
"No, you're not," he said. "No one ever is."
"Ah, suit yourself," said Seyfod, and turned away to ogle the ships. Ford went with him. Only Trillian and Arthur actually went up to Marvin. "No, really we are," said Trillian, and patted him in a way that he disliked intensely. "Hanging around waiting for us all this time."
576,003,579 years, said Marvin. "I counted them."
"Well, we're here now," said Trillian, feeling quite correctly in Marvin's view that it was a slightly foolish thing to say.
"The first 10 million years were the worst," said Marvin, "and the second 10 million, they were the worst too. The third 10 million I didn't enjoy at all. After that I went into a bit of a decline."
Paused just long enough to make them feel they ought to say something, and then interrupted.
"It's the people you meet in this job that really get you down,"
he said, and paused again. Trillian cleared her throat.
"Is that—"
"The best conversation I had was over 40 million years ago,"
continued Marvin. Again the pause.
"Oh dear—"
"And that was with a coffee machine."
He waited.
"Well, that's a—"
"You don't like talking to me, do you?"
said Marvin in a low, desolate tone. Trillian talked to Arthur instead. Further down the chamber, Ford Prefect had found something of which he very much liked the look, several such things, in fact. "Seyfod," he said in a quiet voice, "just look at some of these little star trolleys." Seyfod looked and liked. The craft they were looking at was in fact pretty small, but extraordinary and very much a rich kid's toy. It was not much to look at. It resembled nothing so much as a paper dart about 20 feet long, made of thin but tough metal foil. At the rear end was a small horizontal two-man cockpit. It had a tiny charm-drive engine, which was not capable of moving it at any great speed. The thing it did have, however, was a heatsink. The heatsink had a mass of some 2,000 billion tons, and was contained within a black hole mounted in an electromagnetic field situated halfway along the length of the ship, and this heatsink enabled the craft to be manoeuvred within a few miles of a yellow sun, there to catch and ride the solar flares that burst out from its surface. Flare riding is one of the most exotic and exhilarating sports in existence, and those who can dare and afford to do it are amongst the most lionized men in the galaxy. It is also, of course, stupefyingly dangerous. And those who don't die riding invariably die of sexual exhaustion at one of the Daedalus Club's après flare parties. Ford and Seyfod looked and passed on.
"And this baby," said Ford, "the tangerine star buggy with the black sunbusters."
Again, the star buggy was a small ship, a totally misnamed one, in fact, because the one thing it couldn't manage was interstellar distances. Basically, it was a sporty planet hopper, dolled up to look like something it wasn't. Nice lines, though. They passed on. The next one was a big one and 30 yards long, a coach-built limo ship, and obviously designed with one aim in mind, that of making the beholder sick with envy. The paintwork and accessory detail clearly said, not only am I rich enough to afford this ship, I am also rich enough not to take it seriously. It was wonderfully hideous. Just look at it, said Zaphod. Multi-cluster quark drive, Perspulex running boards. Gotta be a Laszlo Lyricon custom job. He examined every inch. Yes, he said, look, the infra-pink lizard album on the neutrino cowling, Laszlo's trademark. The man has no shame. I was passed by one of these mothers once up by the Axel Nebula, said Ford. I was going flat out, and this thing just strolled past me, star drive hardly taking over. Just incredible. Zaphod whistled appreciatively. 10 seconds later, said Ford, it smashed straight into the third moon of Jaglan Beta. Yeah, right? Amazing-looking ship, though. Looks like a fish, moves like a fish, steers like a cow. Ford looked round the other side. Hey, come see, he called out. There's a big mural painted on this side, a bursting sun. Disaster Area's trademark. This must be Hot Black's ship, lucky old bugger. They do this terrible song, you know, which ends with a stunt ship crashing into the sun. Meant to be an amazing spectacle. Expensive in stunt ships, though. Zaphod's attention, however, was elsewhere. His attention was riveted on the ship standing next to Hot Black Desiato's limo. His mouth hung open. That, he said, that is really bad for the eyes. Ford looked. He too stood astonished. It was a ship of classic, simple design, like a flattened salmon. 20 yards long, very clean, very sleek. There was just one remarkable thing about it. It's so black, said Ford Prefect. You can hardly make out its shape. Light just seems to fall into it. Zaphod said nothing. He had simply fallen in love. The blackness of it was so extreme that it was almost impossible to tell how close you were standing to it. Your eyes just slide off it, said Ford in wonder. It was an emotional moment. He bit his lip. Zaphod moved forward to it, slowly, like a man possessed, or more accurately, like a man who wanted to possess. His hand reached out to stroke it. His hand stopped. His hand reached out to stroke it again. His hand stopped again. Hey, come and feel the surface, he said in a hushed voice. Ford put his hand out to feel it. His hand stopped. You can't, he said. See, said Zaphod, it's just totally frictionless. This must be one mother of a mover. He turned to look at Ford seriously. At least one of his heads did. The other stayed gazing in awe at the ship. What do you reckon, Ford? He said. You mean, Ford looked over his shoulder. You mean, stroll off with it? You think we should? No. Nor do I. But we're going to, aren't we? How can we not? They gazed a little longer, till Zaphod suddenly pulled himself together. We better shift soon, he said. In a moment or so the universe will have ended and all the captain creeps will come pouring down here to find their bourgemobiles. Zaphod, said Ford. Yeah? How do we do it? Ah, simple, said Zaphod. He turned. Marvin, he called. Slowly, laboriously, and with a million little clanking and creaking noises that he'd learned to simulate, Marvin turned round to answer the summons. Come on over here, said Zaphod. We've got a job for you. Marvin trudged towards them.
I won't enjoy it,
he said. Yes, you will, enthused Zaphod. There's a whole new life stretching out ahead of you.
Oh, not another one, groaned Marvin.
Look, will you shut up and listen, hissed Zaphod. This time there's going to be excitement and adventure and really wild things.
Sounds awful.
Marvin, all I'm trying to ask you...
I suppose you want me to open the spaceship for you.
What? Yeah, that's right, said Zaphod jumpily. He was keeping at least 3 eyes on the entrance. Time was short.
Well, I wish you'd just tell me rather than trying to engage my enthusiasm, said Marvin, because I haven't got one.
He walked on up to the ship, touched it, and a hatchway swung open. Ford and Zaphod stared at the opening.
Don't mention it, said Marvin. Oh, you didn't.
He trudged away again. Arthur and Trillian clustered round. What's happening? Asked Arthur.
Look at this, said Fort. Look at the interior of this ship.
Weirder and weirder, breathed Zaphod.
It's black, said Fort. Everything in it is just totally black.
In the restaurant, things were fast approaching the moment after which there wouldn't be any more moments. All eyes were fixed on the dome, other than those of Hot Black Desiato's bodyguard, which were looking intently at Hot Black Desiato, and those of Hot Black Desiato himself, which the bodyguard had closed out of respect. The bodyguard leaned forward over the table. Had Hot Black Desiato been alive, he would probably have deemed this a good moment to lean back or even go for a short walk. His bodyguard was not a man who improved with proximity. On account of his unfortunate condition, however, Hot Black Desiato remained totally inert.
"Mr. Desiato, sir," whispered the bodyguard.
Whenever he spoke, it looked as if the muscles on either side of his mouth were clambering over each other to get out of the way.
"Mr. Desiato, can you hear me?"
Hot Black Desiato, quite naturally, said nothing.
"Hot Black," hissed the bodyguard.
Again, quite naturally, Hot Black Desiato did not reply. Supernaturally, however, he did. On the table in front of him, a wine glass rattled, and a fork rose an inch or so and tapped against the glass. It settled on the table again. The bodyguard gave a satisfied grunt.
"It's time we were going, Mr. Desiato,"
muttered the bodyguard.
"Don't want to get caught in the rush, not in your condition. You want to get to the next gig nice and relaxed. There was a really big audience for it, one of the best, Cacrophoon, 576,002 million years ago. Had you will have been looking forward to it?"
The fork rose again, paused, waggled in a non-committal sort of way, and dropped again.
"Ah, come on," said the bodyguard. "It's going to have been great. You knocked them cold."
The bodyguard would have given Dr. Dan's street mentioner an apoplectic attack.
"The black ship going into the sun always gets them, and the new one's a beauty. Be real sorry to see it go. If we get on down there, I'll set the black ship autopilot and we'll cruise off in the limo, okay?"
The fork tapped once in agreement, and the glass of wine mysteriously emptied itself. The bodyguard wheeled Hot Black Desiato's chair out of the restaurant.
"And now," cried Max from the centre of the stage, "the moment you've all been waiting for." He flung his arms into the air. Behind him, the band went into a frenzy of percussion and rolling synthachords. Max had argued with them about this, but they claimed it was in their contract and that's what they would do. His agent would have to sort it out. "The skies begin to boil," he cried. "Nature collapses into the screaming void. In 20 seconds' time, the universe itself will be at an end. See where the light of infinity bursts in upon us." The hideous fury of destruction blazed about them, and at that moment a still, small trumpet sounded, as from an infinite distance. Max's eyes swiveled round to glare at the band. None of them seemed to be playing a trumpet. Suddenly, a wisp of smoke was swirling and shimmering on the stage next to him. The trumpet was joined by more trumpets. Over 500 times Max had done the show, and nothing like this had ever happened before. He drew back in alarm from the swirling smoke, and as he did so, a figure slowly materialized inside, the figure of an ancient man, bearded, robed, and wreathed in light. In his eyes were stars, and on his brow a golden crown. "What's this?" whispered Max, wild-eyed. "What's happening?" At the back of the restaurant, the stony-faced party from the Church of the Second Coming of the Great Prophet Zarquan leapt ecstatically to their feet, chanting and crying. Max blinked in amazement. He threw up his arms to the audience. "A big hand, please, ladies and gentlemen," he hollered, "for the great prophet Zarquan! He has come! Zarquan has come again!" Thunderous applause broke out as Max strode across the stage and handed his microphone to the prophet. Zarquan coughed. He peered round at the assembled gathering. The stars in his eyes twinkled uneasily. He handled the microphone with confusion. He said, "Hello? Look, I'm sorry I'm a bit late. I've had the most ghastly time, all sorts of things cropping up at the last moment. He seemed nervous at the expectant, awed hush. He cleared his throat. How are we for time?" he said. "Have I just got a..." And so the universe ended.
Chapter 19. One of the major selling points of that wholly remarkable travel book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, apart from its relative cheapness and the fact that it has the words "Don't Panic" written in large friendly letters on its cover, is its compendious and occasionally accurate glossary. The statistics relating to the geosocial nature of the universe, for instance, are deftly set out between pages 938,324 and 938,326. And the simplistic style in which they are written is partly explained by the fact that the editors, having to meet a publishing deadline, copied the information off the back of a packet of breakfast cereal, hastily embroidering it with a few footnotes in order to avoid prosecution under the incomprehensibly tortuous galactic copyright laws. It is interesting to note that a later and wilier editor sent the book backwards in time through a temporal warp and then successfully sued the breakfast cereal company for infringement of the same laws. Here is a sample. The universe. Some information to help you live in it. 1. Area. Infinite. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy offers this definition of the word infinite. Infinite. Bigger than the biggest thing ever, and then some. Much bigger than that, in fact. Really amazingly immense. A totally stunning size. I mean, real, wow, that's big time. Infinity is just so big that by comparison, bigness itself looks really titchy. Gigantic multiplied by colossal multiplied by staggeringly huge is the sort of concept we're trying to get across here. 2. Imports. None. It is impossible to import things into an infinite area, there being no outside to import things in from. 3. Exports. None. See imports. 4. Population. None. It is known that there are an infinite number of worlds simply because there is an infinite amount of space for them to be in. However, not every one of them is inhabited. Therefore, there must be a finite number of inhabited worlds. Any finite number divided by infinity is as near to nothing as makes no odds. So the average population of all the planets in the universe can be said to be zero. From this it follows that the population of the whole universe is also zero, and any people you may meet from time to time are merely the products of a deranged imagination. 5. Monetary units. None. In fact, there are 3 freely convertible currencies in the galaxy, but none of them count. The Altarian dollar has recently collapsed, the Flanian pobble bead is only exchangeable for other Flanian pobble beads, and the Triganic pew has its own very special problems. Its exchange rate of 8 ningis to 1 pew is simple enough, but since a ningi is a triangular rubber coin 6,800 miles along each side, no one has ever collected enough to own 1 pew. Ningis are not negotiable currency because the galactic banks refuse to deal in fiddling small change. From this basic premise, it is simple to prove that the galactic banks are also the product of a deranged imagination. 6. Art. None. The function of art is to hold the mirror up to nature, and there simply isn't a mirror big enough. See point 1. 7. Sex. None. Well, in fact, there is an awful lot of this, largely because of the total lack of money, trade, banks, art, or anything else that might keep all the non-existent people of the universe occupied. However, it is not worth embarking on a long discussion of it now, because it really is terribly complicated. For further information, see Guide Chapters 7, 9, 10, 11, 14, 16, 17, 19, 21 to 84 inclusive, and in fact, most of the rest of the guide.
Chapter 20. The restaurant continued existing, but everything else had stopped. Temporal relostatics held it and protected it in a nothingness that wasn't merely a vacuum, it was simply nothing. There was nothing in which a vacuum could be said to exist. The force-shielded dome had once again been rendered opaque. The party was over. The diners were leaving. Zarquan had vanished along with the rest of the universe. The time turbines were preparing to pull the restaurant back across the brink of time in readiness for the lunch sitting. And Max Quadlepleen was back in his small, curtained dressing room, trying to raise his agent on the tempophone. In the car park stood the black ship, closed and silent. Into the car park came the late Mr. Hot Black Desiato, propelled along the moving catwalk by his bodyguard. They descended one of the tubes. As they approached the limo ship, a hatchway swung down from its side, engaged the wheels of the wheelchair, and drew it inside. The bodyguard followed, and having seen his boss safely connected up to his death support system, moved up to the small cockpit. Here he operated the remote control system, which activated the autopilot in the black ship lying next to the limo, thus causing great relief to Zaphod Beeblebrox, who had been trying to start the thing for over 10 minutes. The black ship glided smoothly forward out of its bay, turned, and moved down the central causeway swiftly and quietly. At the end it accelerated rapidly, flung itself into the temporal launch chamber, and began the long journey back into the distant past. The Milliway's lunch menu quotes, by permission, a passage from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The passage is this: "The history of every major galactic civilization tends to pass through three distinct and recognizable phases, those of survival, inquiry, and sophistication, otherwise known as the how, why, and where phases. For instance, the first phase is characterized by the question, how can we eat? The second by the question, why do we eat? And the third by the question, where shall we have lunch?" The menu goes on to suggest that Milliway's, the restaurant at the end of the universe, would be a very agreeable and sophisticated answer to that third question. What it doesn't go on to say is that though it'll usually take a large civilization many thousands of years to pass through the how, why, and where phases, small social groupings under stressful conditions can pass through them with extreme rapidity. "How are we doing?" said Arthur Dent. "Badly," said Ford Prefect. "Where are we going?" said Trillian. "I don't know," said Zaphod Beeblebrox. "Why not?" demanded Arthur Dent. "Shut up," suggested Zaphod Beeblebrox and Ford Prefect. "Basically what you're trying to say," said Arthur Dent, ignoring the suggestion, "is that we're out of control." The ship was rocking and swaying sickeningly as Ford and Zaphod tried to wrest control from the autopilot. The engines howled and whined like tired children in a supermarket. "It's the wild colour screen that freaks me," said Zaphod, whose love affair with the ship had lasted almost 3 minutes into the flight. "Every time you try to operate one of these weird black controls that are labelled in black on a black background, a little black light lights up black to let you know you've done it. I mean, what is this, some kind of galactic hyperhearse?" The walls of the swaying cabin were also black. The ceiling was black. The seats, which were rudimentary since the only important trip this ship was designed for was supposed to be unmanned, were black. The control panel was black. The instruments were black, the little screws that held them in place were black, the thin tufted nylon floor covering was black, and when they lifted up a corner of it they discovered that the foam underlay was also black. "Perhaps whoever designed it had eyes that responded to different wavelengths," offered Trillian. "Or didn't have much imagination," muttered Arthur.
"Perhaps," said Marvin. "He was feeling very depressed."
In fact, though they didn't know it, the decor had been chosen in honour of its owner's sad, lamented, and tax-deductible condition. The ship gave a particularly sickening lurch. "Take it easy," pleaded Arthur. "Well, you're making me space-sick." "Time-sick," said Ford. "We're plummeting backwards through time." "Thank you," said Arthur. "Now I think I really am going to be ill." "Ah, go ahead," said Zaphod. "We could do a little colour about the place." "This is meant to be polite after-dinner conversation, is it?" snapped Arthur. Zaphod left the controls to Ford to figure out, and lurched over to Arthur. "Look, Earthman," he said angrily, "you've got a job to do, right? The question to the element answer, right?" "What, that thing?" said Arthur. "I thought we'd forgotten about that." "Not me, baby. Like the mice said, it's worth a lot of money in the right quarters, and it's all locked up in that head thing of yours." "Yes, but nothing. You think about it. The meaning of life. We get our fingers on that, we can hold every shrink in the galaxy up to ransom, and that's worth a bundle. I owe mine a mint." Arthur took a deep breath without much enthusiasm. "All right," he said, "but where do we start? I mean, how should I know? They say the ultimate answer or whatever is 42. How am I supposed to know what the question is? It could be anything. I mean, what's 6 times 7? Zaphod looked at him hard for a moment. Then his eyes blazed with excitement. 42! He cried. Arthur wiped his palm across his forehead. "Yes," he said patiently, "I know that." Zaphod's faces fell. "I'm just saying the question could be anything at all," said Arthur, "and I don't see how I'm meant to know." "Because," hissed Zaphod, "you were there when your planet did the big firework." "We have a thing on Earth," began Arthur. "Had," corrected Zaphod, "called tact." "Oh, never mind. Look, I just don't know."
A low voice echoed dully round the cabin.
"I know," said Marvin.
Ford called out from the controls he was still fighting a losing battle with. "Stay out of this, Marvin," he said. "This is organism talk."
"It's printed in the Earthman's brainwave patterns," continued Marvin. "But I don't suppose you'll be very interested in knowing that."
"You mean," said Arthur, "you mean you can see into my mind?"
"Yes,"
said Marvin. Arthur stared in astonishment. "And," he said,
It amazes me how you manage to live in anything that small.
Ah, said Arthur, abuse.
Yes,
confirmed Marvin. Ah, ignore him, said Zaphod, he's only making it up.
Making it up,
said Marvin, swivelling his head in a parody of astonishment.
Why should I want to make anything up? Life's bad enough as it is without wanting to invent any more of it.
Marvin, said Trillian, in the gentle, kindly voice that only she was still capable of assuming in talking to this misbegotten creature, if you knew all along, then why didn't you tell us? Marvin's head swivelled back to her.
You didn't ask, he said simply.
Well, we're asking you now, metal man, said Ford, turning round to look at him. At that moment, the ship suddenly stopped rocking and swaying. The engine pitch settled down to a gentle hum. Hey, Ford, said Zaphod. That sounds good. Have you worked out the controls on this boat? No, said Ford. I just stopped fiddling with them. I reckon we've just got to go wherever this ship is going and get off it fast. Yeah, right, said Zaphod.
I could tell you weren't really interested, murmured Marvin to himself, and slumped into a corner and switched himself off.
Trouble is, said Ford, that the one instrument in this whole ship that's giving any reading is worrying me. If it's what I think it is, and it's saying what I think it's saying, then we've already gone too far back into the past, maybe as much as 2 million years before our own time. Zaphod shrugged. Time is bunk, he said. I wonder who this ship belongs to, anyway, said Arthur. Me, said Zaphod. No, I mean who it really belongs to. No, really me, insisted Zaphod. Look, property is theft, right? Therefore theft is property, therefore the ship is mine, okay? Tell the ship that, said Arthur. Zaphod strode over to the console. Ship, he said, banging on the panels. This is your new owner speaking to... He got no further. Several things happened at once. The ship dropped out of time travel mode and re-emerged into real space. All the controls on the console, which had been shut down for the time trip, now lit up. A large vision screen above the console winked into life, revealing a wide starscape, and a single, very large sun, dead ahead of them. None of these things, however, was responsible for the fact that Zaphod was at the same moment hurled bodily backwards against the rear of the cabin, as were all the others. They were hurled back by a single, thunderous clap of noise that thudded out of the monitor speakers surrounding the vision screen. Chapter 21 Down on the dry, red world of Cacrophoon, in the middle of the vast rudlit desert, the stage technicians were testing the sound system. That is to say, the sound system was in the desert, not the technicians. They had retreated to the safety of Disaster Area's giant control ship, which hung in orbit some 400 miles above the surface of the planet, and they were testing the sound from there. Anyone within 5 miles of the speaker silos wouldn't have survived the tuning up. If Arthur Dent had been within 5 miles of the speaker silos, then his expiring thought would have been that in both size and shape, the sound rig closely resembled Manhattan. Risen out of the silos, the neutron phase speaker stacks towered monstrously against the sky, obscuring the banks of plutonium reactors and seismic amps behind them. Buried deep in concrete bunkers beneath the city of speakers lay the instruments that the musicians would control from their ship. The massive photon adduitar, the bass detonator, and the megabang drum complex. It was going to be a noisy show. Aboard the giant control ship, all was activity and bustle. Hot Black Desiato's limo ship, a mere tadpole beside it, had arrived and docked, and the lamented gentleman was being transported down the high vaulted corridors to meet the medium who was going to interpret his psychic impulses onto the adduitar keyboard. A doctor, a logician, and a marine biologist had also arrived, flown in at phenomenal expense from Maximegalon to try to reason with the lead singer, who had locked himself in the bathroom with a bottle of pills and was refusing to come out till it could be proved conclusively to him that he wasn't a fish. The bass player was busy machine-gunning his bedroom, and the drummer was nowhere on board. Frantic inquiries led to the discovery that he was standing on a beach on Santragenus V, over 100 light-years away, where, he claimed, he had been happy for over half an hour now, and had found a small stone that would be his friend. The band's manager was profoundly relieved. It meant that for the 17th time on this tour, the drums would be played by a robot, and that, therefore, the timing of the cymbalistics would be right. The sub-ether was buzzing with the communications of the stage technicians testing the speaker channels, and this it was that was being relayed to the interior of the black ship. Its dazed occupants lay against the back wall of the cabin and listened to the voices on the monitor speakers. "Okay, channel 9 on power," said a voice. "Testing channel 15. Another thumping crack of noise walloped through the ship. "Channel 15, A-okay," said another voice. A third voice cut in. "The black stunt ship is now in position," it said. "It's looking good. Going to be a great sundive. Stage computer online?" A computer voice answered.
"Online,"
it said. "Take control of the black ship." "Black ship locked into trajectory program. On standby. Testing channel 20. Seyfort leapt across the cabin and switched frequencies on the sub-ether receiver before the next mind-pulverizing noise hit them. He stood there quivering. "What," said Trillian in a small, quiet voice, "does sundive mean?"
"It means," said Marvin, "that the ship is going to dive into the sun. Sun. Dive. It's very simple to understand. What do you expect if you see a hot black Desiato stunt ship?"
"How do you know," said Zaphod in a voice that would make a vegan snow lizard feel chilly, "that this is hot black Desiato's stunt ship?"
"Simple," said Marvin. "I parked it for him."
"Then why didn't you tell us?"
"You said you wanted excitement and adventure and really wild things."
"This is awful," said Arthur, unnecessarily in the pause which followed.
"That's what I said," confirmed Marvin.
On a different frequency, the sub-ether receiver had picked up a public broadcast which now echoed around the cabin. "Fine weather for the concert here this afternoon. I'm standing here in the front of the stage," the reporter lied, "in the middle of the red-lit desert, and with the aid of hyperbinoptic glasses, I can just about make out the huge audience cowering there on the horizon all around me. Behind me, the speaker stacks rise like a sheer cliff face, and high above me, the sun is shining away and doesn't know what's going to hit it. The environmentalist lobby do know what's going to hit it, and they claim that the concert will cause earthquakes, tidal waves, hurricanes, irreparable damage to the atmosphere, and all the usual things that environmentalists usually go on about. But I've just had a report that a representative of disaster area met with environmentalists at lunchtime and had them all shot, so nothing now lies in the way of—" Zaphod switched it off. He turned to Ford. "You know what I'm thinking," he said. "I think so," said Ford. "Tell me what you think I'm thinking." "I think you're thinking it's time we got off this ship." "I think you're right," said Zaphod. "I think you're right," said Ford. "How?" said Arthur. "Quiet," said Ford and Zaphod. "We're thinking." "So this is it," said Arthur. "We're going to die." "I wish you'd stop saying that," said Ford. It is worth repeating at this point the theories that Ford had come up with on his first encounter with human beings to account for their peculiar habit of continually stating and restating the very, very obvious, as in, "It's a nice day," or "You're very tall," or "So this is it, we're going to die." His first theory was that if human beings didn't keep exercising their lips, their mouths probably seized up. After a few months of observation, he'd come up with a second theory, which was this. If human beings don't keep exercising their lips, their brains start working. In fact, the second theory is more literally true of the Belcerebon people of Cacrafoon. The Belcerebon people used to cause great resentment and insecurity amongst neighbouring races by being one of the most enlightened, accomplished, and above all, quiet civilizations in the galaxy. As a punishment for this behaviour, which was held to be offensively self-righteous and provocative, a galactic tribunal inflicted on them that most cruel of all social diseases, telepathy. Consequently, in order to prevent themselves broadcasting every slightest thought that crosses their mind to anyone within a 5-mile radius, they now have to talk very loudly and continuously about the weather, their little aches and pains, the match this afternoon, and what a noisy place Cacrafoon has suddenly become. Another method of temporarily blotting out their minds is to play host to a disaster area concert. The timing of the concert was critical. The ship had to begin its dive before the concert began in order to hit the sun 6 minutes and 37 seconds before the climax of the song to which it related, so that the light of the solar flares had time to travel out to Cacrafoon. The ship had already been diving for several minutes by the time that Ford Prefect had completed his search of the other compartments of the black ship. He burst back into the cabin. The sun of Cacrafoon loomed terrifyingly large on the vision screen, its blazing white inferno of fusing hydrogen nuclei growing moment by moment as the ship plunged onwards, unheeding the thumping and banging of Zaphod's hands on the control panel. Arthur and Trillian had the fixed expressions of rabbits on a night road who think the best way of dealing with approaching headlights is to stare them out. Zaphod spun round, wild-eyed. "Ford," he said, "how many escape capsules are there?" "None," said Ford. Zaphod gibbered. "Did you count them?" he yelled. "Twice," said Ford. "Did you manage to raise the stage crew on the radio?" "Yeah," said Zaphod bitterly. "I said there are a whole bunch of people on board, and they said to say hi to everybody." Ford goggled. "Didn't you tell them who you were?" "Oh, yeah, they said it was a great honour. That and something about a restaurant bill and my executors." Ford pushed Arthur aside roughly and leaned forward over the control console. "Does none of this function?" he said savagely. "All overridden. Smash the autopilot. Find it first. Nothing connects." There was a moment's cold silence. Arthur was stumbling round the back of the cabin. He stopped suddenly. "Incidentally," he said, "what does teleport mean?" Another moment passed. Slowly the others turned to face him. "Probably the wrong question to ask," said Arthur. "It's just I remember hearing you use the word a short while ago, and I only bring it up because..." "Where," said Ford quietly, "does it say teleport?" "Well, just over here, in fact," said Arthur, pointing at a dark control box in the rear of the cabin. "Just under the word emergency, above the word system, and beside the sign saying out of order." In the pandemonium that instantly followed, the only action to follow was that of Ford Prefect lunging across the cabin to the small black box that Arthur had indicated and stabbing repeatedly at the single small black button set into it. A 6-foot square panel slid open beside it, revealing a compartment which resembled a multiple shower unit that had found a new function in life as an electrician's junk store. Half-finished wiring hung from the ceiling, a jumble of abandoned components lay strewn on the floor, and the programming panel lolled out of the cavity in the wall into which it should have been secured. A junior disaster area accountant, visiting the shipyard where the ship was being constructed, had demanded to know of the works foreman why the hell they were fitting an extremely expensive teleport into a ship that only had one important journey to make, and that unmanned. The foreman had explained that the teleport was available at a 10% discount, and the accountant had explained that this is immaterial. The foreman had explained that it was the finest, most powerful and sophisticated teleport that money could buy, and the accountant had explained that the money did not wish to buy it. The foreman had explained that the people would still need to enter and leave the ship, and the accountant had explained that the ship sported a perfectly serviceable door. The foreman had explained that the accountant could go and boil his head, and the accountant had explained to the foreman that the thing approaching him rapidly from his left was a knuckle sandwich. After the explanations had been concluded, work was discontinued on the teleport, which subsequently passed unnoticed on the invoice as Sund Explans, at 5 times the price. "Hell's donkeys," muttered Zaphod as he and Ford attempted to sort through the tangle of wiring. After a moment or so, Ford told him to stand back. He tossed a coin into the teleport and jiggled a switch on the lolling control panel. With a crackle and a spit of light, the coin vanished. "That much of it works," said Ford. "However, there's no guidance system. A mere matter transference teleport with no guidance programming could put you, well, anywhere." The son of Cacrafoon loomed huge on the screen. "Who cares?" said Zaphod. "We go where we go." "And," said Ford, "there's no auto system. We couldn't all go. Someone would have to stay here and operate it." A solemn moment shuffled past. The sun loomed larger and larger. "Hey, Marvin, kid," said Zaphod brightly. "How you doing?"
"Very badly, I suspect," muttered Marvin.
A shortish while later, the concert on Cacrafoon reached an unexpected climax. The black ship with its single morose occupant had plunged on schedule into the nuclear furnace of the sun. Massive solar flares licked out from it millions of miles into space, thrilling and in some cases spilling the dozen or so flare riders who had been coasting close to the surface of the sun in anticipation of the moment. Moments before the flare light reached Cacrafoon, the pounding desert cracked along a deep fault line. A huge and hitherto undetected underground river, lying far beneath the sand, gushed to the surface to be followed seconds later by the eruption of millions of tons of boiling lava that flowed hundreds of feet into the air, instantaneously vaporizing the river both above and below the surface in an explosion that echoed to the far side of the world and back again. Those very few who witnessed the event and survived swear that the whole 100,000 square miles of the desert rose into the air like a mile-thick pancake, flipped itself over and fell back down again. At that precise moment, the solar radiation from the flares filtered through the clouds of vaporized water and struck the ground. A year later, the 100,000 square mile desert was thick with flowers. The structure of the atmosphere around the planet was subtly altered. The sun blazed less harshly in the summer, the cold bit less bitterly in the winter. Pleasant rain fell more often, and slowly the desert world of Cacrafoon became a paradise. Even the telepathic power with which the people of Cacrafoon had been cursed was permanently dispersed by the force of the explosion. A spokesman for Disaster Area, the one who had had all the environmentalists shot, was later quoted as saying that it had been a good gig. Many people spoke movingly of the healing powers of music. A few sceptical scientists examined the records of the events even more closely and claimed that they had discovered faint vestiges of a vast, artificially induced improbability field drifting in from a nearby region of space. Chapter 22. Arthur woke and instantly regretted it. Hangovers he'd had, but never anything on this scale. This was it. This was the big one. This was the ultimate pits. Matter transference beams, he decided, were not as much fun as, say, a good solid kick in the head. Being for the moment unwilling to move on account of a dull, stomping throb he was experiencing, he lay a while and thought. The trouble with most forms of transport, he thought, is basically one of them not being worth all the bother. On Earth, when there had been an Earth, before it was demolished to make way for a hyperspace bypass, the problem had been with cars. The disadvantages involved in pulling lots of black sticky slime from out of the ground, where it had been safely hidden out of harm's way, turning it into tar to cover the land with, smoke to fill the air with, and pouring the rest into the sea, all seemed to outweigh the advantages of being able to get more quickly from one place to another, particularly when the place you arrived at had probably become, as a result of this, very similar to the place you had left, i.e. covered with tar, full of smoke, and short of fish. And what about matter transference beams? Any form of transport which involved tearing you apart atom by atom, flinging those atoms through the sub-ether, and then jamming them back together again just when they were getting their first taste of freedom for years, had to be bad news. Many people had thought exactly this before Arthur Dent, and had even gone to the lengths of writing songs about it. Here is one that used regularly to be chanted by huge crowds outside the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation Teleport Systems factory on Happy World 3. Aldebaran's great, okay, Algol's pretty neat, Beetlejuice's pretty girls will knock you off your feet, they'll do anything you like, real fast and then real slow, but if you have to take me apart to get me there, then I don't want to go. Singing, take me apart, what a way to roam, and if you have to take me apart to get me there, I'd rather stay at home. Sirius is paved with gold, so I've heard it said, by nuts who then go on to say, see Tor before you're dead. I'll gladly take the high road, or even take the low, but if you have to take me apart to get me there, then I, for one, won't go. Singing, take me apart, you must be off your head, and if you try to take me apart to get me there, I'll stay right here in bed. And so on. Another favourite song was much shorter. I teleported home one night with Ron and Sid and Meg. Ron stole Meggie's heart away, and I got Sidney's leg. Arthur felt waves of pain slowly receding, though he was still aware of a dull, stomping throb. Slowly, carefully, he stood up. "Can you hear a dull, stomping throb?" said Ford Prefect. Arthur spun round and wobbled uncertainly. Ford Prefect was approaching, looking red-eyed and pasty. "Where are we?" gasped Arthur. Ford looked around. They were standing in a long, curving corridor, which stretched out of sight in both directions. The outer steel wall, which was painted in that sickly shade of pale green which they use in schools, hospitals and mental asylums to keep the inmates subdued, curved over the tops of their heads to where it met the inner perpendicular wall which, oddly enough, was covered in dark brown Hessian wall weave. The floor was of dark green ribbed rubber. Ford moved over to a very thick, dark, transparent panel set in the outer wall. It was several layers deep, yet through it you could see pinpoints of distant stars. "I think we're in a spaceship of some kind," he said. Down the corridor came the sound of a dull, stomping throb. "Trillion?" called Arthur nervously. "Zaphod?" Ford shrugged. "Nowhere about," he said. "I've looked. They could be anywhere. An unprogrammed teleport can throw you light-years in any direction. Judging by the way I feel, I should think we've travelled a very long way indeed." "Well, how do you feel?" "Bad." "Do you think they're..." "Where they are, how they are, there's no way we can know and no way we can do anything about it. Do what I do." "What?" "Don't think about it." Arthur turned this thought over in his mind, reluctantly saw the wisdom of it, tucked it up and put it away. He took a deep breath. "Footsteps!" exclaimed Arthur suddenly. "Where?" "That noise, that stomping throb, pounding feet, listen!" Arthur listened. The noise echoed round the corridor at them from an indeterminate distance. It was the muffled sound of pounding footsteps, and it was noticeably louder. "Let's move," said Ford sharply. They both moved in opposite directions. "Not that way," said Ford. "That's where they're coming from." "No, it's not," said Arthur. "They're coming from that way." "They're not there." They both stopped. They both turned. They both listened intently. They both agreed with each other. They both set off in opposite directions again. Fear gripped them. From both directions, the noise was getting louder. A few yards to their left, another corridor ran at right angles to the inner wall. They ran to it and hurried along it. It was dark, immensely long, and as they passed down it, gave them the impression that they were getting colder and colder. Other corridors gave off it to the left and right, each very dark and each subjecting them to sharp blasts of icy air as they passed. They stopped for a moment in alarm. The further down the corridor they went, the louder became the sound of pounding feet. They pressed themselves back against the cold wall and listened furiously. The cold, the dark, and the drumming of disembodied feet were getting to them badly. Ford shivered, partly with the cold, but partly with the memory of stories his favourite mother used to tell him when he was a mere slip of a Betelgeusean, ankle-high to an Arcturian mega-grasshopper. Stories of death ships, haunted hulks that roamed restlessly around the obscurer regions of deep space, infested with demons or the ghosts of forgotten crews. Stories, too, of incautious travellers who found and entered such ships. Stories of... Then Ford remembered the brown Hessian wall weave in the first corridor and pulled himself together. However ghosts and demons may choose to decorate their death hulks, he thought to himself, he would lay any money you liked that it wasn't with Hessian wall weave. He grasped Arthur by the arm. "Back the way he came," he said firmly, and they started to retrace their steps. A moment later they leapt like startled lizards down the nearest corridor junction, as the owners of the drumming feet suddenly hove into view directly in front of them. Hidden behind the corner, they goggled in amazement as about 24 overweight men and women pounded past them in tracksuits, panting and wheezing in a manner that would make a heart surgeon gibber. Ford Prefect stared after them. "Joggers," he hissed, as the sound of their feet echoed away up and down the network of corridors. "Joggers?" whispered Arthur Dent. "Joggers," said Ford Prefect with a shrug. The corridor they were concealed in was not like the others. It was very short and ended at a large steel door. Ford examined it, discovered the opening mechanism, and pushed it wide. The first thing that hit their eyes was what appeared to be a coffin. The next 4,999 things that hit their eyes were also coffins. Chapter 23. The vault was low-ceilinged, dimly lit, and gigantic. At the far end, about 300 yards away, an archway led through to what appeared to be a similar chamber, similarly occupied. Ford Prefect let out a low whistle as he stepped down to the floor of the vault. "Wild," he said. "What's so great about dead people?" asked Arthur, nervously, stepping down after him. "Dunno," said Ford. "Let's find out, shall we?" On a closer inspection, the coffins seemed to be more like sarcophagi. They stood about waist high and were constructed of what appeared to be white marble, which is almost certainly what it was, something that only appeared to be white marble. The tops were semi-translucent, and through them could dimly be perceived the features of their late and presumably lamented occupants. They were humanoid and had clearly left the troubles of whatever world it was they came from far behind them, but beyond that, little else could be discerned. Rolling slowly round the floor between the sarcophagi was a heavy, oily, white gas, which Arthur at first thought might be there to give the place a little atmosphere, until he discovered that it also froze his ankles. The sarcophagi, too, were intensely cold to the touch. Ford suddenly crouched down beside one of them. He pulled a corner of his towel out of his satchel and started to rub furiously at something. "Look, there's a plaque on this one," he explained to Arthur. "It's frosted over." He rubbed the frost clear and examined the engraved characters. To Arthur, they looked like the footprints of a spider that had had one too many of whatever it is that spiders have on a night out. But Ford instantly recognized an early form of galactic easy read. It says, "Golgafrinchum Ark Fleet, Ship B, Hold 7, Telephone Sanitizer, Second Class," and a serial number. telephone sanitizer, said Arthur. A dead telephone sanitizer.
Best kind.
But what's he doing here?
Ford peered through the top at the figure within.
Not a lot, he said, and suddenly flashed one of those grins of his which always make people think he'd been overdoing things recently and should try and get some rest. He scampered over to another sarcophagus, a moment's brisk towel work, and he announced, "This one's a dead hairdresser, Hoopy."
The next sarcophagus revealed itself to be the last resting place of an advertising account executive. The one after that contained a second-hand car salesman, third class.
An inspection hatch let into the floor suddenly caught Ford's attention, and he squatted down to unfasten it, thrashing away at the clouds of freezing gas that threatened to envelop him.
A thought occurred to Arthur. "If these are just coffins," he said, "why are they kept so cold?"
"Or indeed, why are they kept anyway?" said Ford, tugging the hatchway open. The gas poured down through it. Why, in fact, is anyone going to all the trouble and expense of carting 5,000 dead bodies through space?
10,000, said Arthur, pointing at the archway through which the next chamber was dimly visible.
Ford stuck his head down through the floor hatchway. He looked up again.
15,000, he said. There's another lot down there.
15 million,
said a voice.
That's a lot, said Ford. A lot.
Turn round slowly, barked the voice, and put your hands up. Any other move and I'll blast you into tiny, tiny bits.
Hello? Said Ford, turning round slowly, putting his hands up and not making any other move.
Why, said Arthur Dent, isn't anyone ever pleased to see us?
Standing silhouetted in the doorway through which they had entered the vault was the man who wasn't pleased to see them. His displeasure was communicated partly by the barking, hectoring quality of his voice and partly by the viciousness with which he waved a long, silver Killer-Zap gun at them. The designer of the gun had clearly not been instructed to beat about the bush. Make it evil, he'd been told. Make it totally clear that this gun has a right end and a wrong end. Make it totally clear to anyone standing at the wrong end that things are going badly for them. If that means sticking all sorts of spikes and prongs and blackened bits all over it, then so be it. This is not a gun for hanging over the fireplace or sticking in the umbrella stand. It is a gun for going out and making people miserable with.
Ford and Arthur looked at the gun unhappily. The man with the gun moved from the door and circled round them. As he came into the light, they could see his gold and black uniform, on which the buttons are so highly polished that they shone with an intensity that would have made an approaching motorist flash his lights in annoyance. He gestured at the door.
Out!
He said. People who can supply that amount of firepower don't need to supply verbs as well. Ford and Arthur went out, closely followed by the wrong end of the Killer-Zap gun and the buttons. Turning into the corridor, they were jostled by 24 oncoming joggers, now showered and changed, who swept on past them into the vault. Arthur turned to watch them in confusion.
Move!
Screamed their captor. Arthur moved. Ford shrugged and moved. In the vault, the joggers went to 24 empty sarcophagi along the side wall, opened them, climbed in, and fell into 24 dreamless sleeps.
Chapter 24.
Captain?
Yes, number one?
Just had a sort of report thingy from number two.
Oh, dear.
High up on the bridge of the ship, the captain stared out into the infinite reaches of space with mild irritation. From where he reclined beneath a wide-domed bubble, he could see before and above him the vast panorama of stars through which they were moving, a panorama that had thinned out noticeably during the course of the voyage. Turning and looking backwards over the vast 2-mile bulk of the ship, he could see the far denser mass of stars behind them, which seemed to form almost a solid band. This was the view through the galactic centre, from which they were travelling, and indeed had been travelling for years, at a speed that he couldn't quite remember at the moment, but he knew it was terribly fast. It was something approaching the speed of something or other, or was it 3 times the speed of something else? Jolly impressive, anyway. He peered into the bright distance behind the ship, looking for something. He did this every few minutes or so, but never found what he was looking for. He didn't let it worry him, though. The scientist chaps had been very insistent that everything was going to be perfectly all right, provided nobody panicked and everybody got on and did their bit in an orderly fashion. He wasn't panicking. As far as he was concerned, everything was going splendidly. He dabbed at his shoulder with a large frothy sponge.
It crept back into his mind that he was feeling mildly irritated about something. Now, what was all that about? A slight cough alerted him to the fact that the ship's first officer was still standing nearby. Nice chap, number one. Not one of the very brightest. Had the odd spot of difficulty doing up his shoelaces, but jolly good officer material for all that. The captain wasn't a man to kick a chap when he was bending over trying to do up his shoelaces, however long it took him. Not like that ghastly number two, strutting about all over the place, polishing his buttons, issuing reports every hour. Ship still moving, captain. Still on course, captain. Oxygen level still being maintained, captain. Give it a miss, was the captain's vote. Ah, yes, that was a thing that had been irritating him. He peered down at number one. Yes, captain, he was shouting something or other about having found some prisoners. The captain thought about this. Seemed pretty unlikely to him, but he wasn't one to stand in his officer's way. Well, perhaps that'll keep him happy for a bit, he said. He's always wanted some. Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent trudged onwards up the ship's apparently endless corridors. Number two marched behind them, barking the occasional order about not making any false moves or trying any funny stuff. They seemed to have passed at least a mile of continuous brown Hessian wall weave. Finally they reached a large steel door, which slid open when number two shouted at it. They entered. To the eyes of Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent, the most remarkable thing about the ship's bridge was not the 50-foot diameter hemispherical dome which covered it, and through which the dazzling display of stars shone down on them. To people who have eaten at the restaurant at the end of the universe, such wonders are commonplace. Nor was it the bewildering array of instruments that crowded the long circumferential wall around them. To Arthur, this was exactly what spaceships were traditionally supposed to look like. And to Ford, it looked thoroughly antiquated. It confirmed his suspicions that Disaster Area's stunt ship had taken them back at least 1 million, if not 2 million, years before their own time. No, the thing that really caught them off balance was the bath. The bath stood on a 6-foot pedestal of rough-hewn blue water crystal and was of a baroque monstrosity not often seen outside the Maxi Megalon Museum of Diseased Imaginings. An intestinal jumble of plumbing had been picked out in gold leaf rather than decently buried at midnight in an unmarked grave. The taps and shower attachment would have made a gargoyle jump. As the dominant centrepiece of a starship bridge, it was terribly wrong. And it was with the embittered air of a man who knew this that number two approached it. "Captain, sir!" he shouted through clenched teeth. A difficult trick, but he'd had years during which to perfect it. A large genial face and a genial foam-covered arm popped up over the rim of the monstrous bath. "Ah, hello, number two," said Captain, waving a cheery sponge. "Having a nice day?" Number two snapped even further to attention than he already was. "I have brought you the prisoners I located in Freezer Bay 7, sir," he yapped. Ford and Arthur coughed in confusion. "Hello," they said. The captain beamed at them. So, number two had really found some prisoners. Well, good for him, thought the captain. Nice to see a chap doing what he's best at. "Oh, hello there," he said. "Excuse me not getting up, just having a quick bath. Well, gin and tonics all round, then. Look in the fridge, number one." "Certainly, sir." It is a curious fact, and one to which no one knows quite how much importance to attach, that something like 85% of all known worlds in the galaxy, be they primitive or highly advanced, have invented a drink called gin and tonics, or gin and tonics, or gin and onyx, or any one of a thousand or more variations on the same phonetic theme. The drinks themselves are not the same, and vary between the Sivolvian chinantomnix, which is ordinary water served at slightly above room temperature, and the Gagrakakan chinantonix, which kills cows at 100 paces. And in fact, the one common factor between all of them, beyond the fact that the names sound the same, is that they were all invented and named before the worlds concerned made contact with any other worlds. What can be made of this fact? It exists in total isolation. As far as any theory of structural linguistics is concerned, it is right off the graph, and yet it persists. Old structural linguists get very angry when young structural linguists go on about it. Young structural linguists get deeply excited about it and stay up late at night, convinced that they are very close to something of profound importance, and end up becoming old structural linguists before their time, getting very angry with the young ones. Structural linguistics is a bitterly divided and unhappy discipline, and a large number of its practitioners spend too many nights drowning their sorrows in whiskey and sodas. Number two stood before the captain's bathtub, trembling with frustration.
"Don't you want to interrogate the prisoners, sir?"
he squealed. Captain peered at him in bemusement. "Why on Golgotha Frensham should I want to do that?" he asked.
"To get information out of them, sir! To find out why they came here!"
"Oh, no, 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 no," said the captain. "I expect they just dropped in for a quick gin and tonics, don't you?"
"But, sir, they're my prisoners! I must interrogate them!"
Captain looked at them doubtfully. "Oh, all right," he said. "Well, if you must, ask them what they want to drink." A hard, cold gleam came into Number Two's eyes. He advanced slowly on Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent.
"All right, you scum," he growled. "You vermin!"
He jabbed forward with a killer zap gun. "Steady on, Number Two," admonished the captain gently.
"What do you want to drink?"
Number Two screamed. "Well, the gin and tonics sounds very nice to me," said Ford. "What about you, Arthur?" Arthur blinked. "What? Oh, yes," he said.
"With ice or without?"
bellowed Number Two. "Oh, with, please," said Ford.
"Lemon!"
Yes, please," said Ford. "And do you have any of those little biscuits, you know, the cheesy ones?"
"I'm asking the questions!"
howled Number Two, his body quaking with apoplectic fury. "Number Two," said the captain softly.
"Sir!"
"Push off, would you? There's a good chap. I'm trying to have a relaxing bath." Number Two's eyes narrowed and became what are known in the shouting and killing people trade as cold slits, the idea presumably being to give your opponent the impression that you have lost your glasses or having difficulty keeping awake. Why this is frightening is an as yet unresolved problem. He advanced on the captain, his, Number Two's, mouth a thin, hard line. Again, tricky to know why this is understood as frightening behaviour. If, whilst wandering through the jungle of Tral, you were suddenly to come upon the fabled, ravenous bug-bladder beast, you would have reason to be grateful if its mouth was a thin, hard line, rather than, as it usually is, a gaping mass of slavering fangs.
"May I remind you, sir," hissed Number Two at the captain, "that you have now been in that bath for over 3 years?"
This final shot delivered, Number Two spun on his heel and stalked off to a corner to practice darting eye movements in the mirror. The captain squirmed in his bath. He gave Ford Prefect a lame smile.
"Well, you need to relax a lot in a job like mine," he said.
Ford slowly lowered his hands. It provoked no reaction. Arthur lowered his. Treading very slowly and carefully, Ford moved over to the bath pedestal. He patted it. "Nice," he lied. He wondered if it was safe to grin. Very slowly and carefully, he grinned. It was safe. He said to the captain.
"Yes,"
said the captain. "I wonder," said Ford, "could I ask you actually what your job is, in fact?" A hand tapped him on the shoulder. He spun round. It was the first officer. "Your drinks," he said.
"Oh, thank you," said Ford.
He and Arthur took their gin and tonics. Arthur sipped his and was surprised to discover it tasted very like a whiskey and soda.
"I mean, I couldn't help noticing,"
said Ford, also taking a sip, "the bodies in the hold."
"Bodies?"
said the captain in surprise. Ford paused and thought to himself. Never take anything for granted, he thought. Could it be that the captain doesn't know he's got 15 million dead bodies on this ship? The captain was nodding cheerfully at him. He also appeared to be playing with a rubber duck. Ford looked around. Number Two was staring at him in the mirror, but only for an instant. His eyes were constantly on the move. The first officer was just standing there holding the drinks tray and smiling benignly.
"Bodies?"
said the captain again. Ford licked his lips.
"Yes," he said. "All those dead telephone sanitizers and account executives, you know, down in the hold."
The captain stared at him. Suddenly he threw back his head and laughed.
"Oh, they're not dead," he said. "Good Lord, no, no, no. They're frozen. They're going to be revived."
Ford did something he very rarely did. He blinked. Arthur seemed to come out of a trance.
"You mean you've got a hold full of frozen hairdressers?" he said.
"Oh, yes," said the captain. "Millions of them. Hairdressers, tired TV producers, insurance salesmen, personnel officers, security guards, public relations executives, management consultants, you name it. We're going to colonise another planet." Ford wobbled very slightly.
"Exciting, isn't it?"
said the captain.
"What with that lot?"
said Arthur.
"Ah, no, 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 don't misunderstand me," said the captain. "We're just one of the ships in the Ark fleet. We're the B Ark, you see. Sorry, could I just ask you to run a little bit more hot water for me?"
Arthur obliged. and a cascade of pink, frothy water swirled around the bath. The captain let out a sigh of pleasure. "Thank you so much, my dear fellow. Do help yourself to more drinks, of course." Ford tossed down his drink, took the bottle from the first officer's tray, and refilled his glass to the top. "What," he said, "is a B-arc?" "This is," said the captain, and swished the foamy water around joyfully with the duck. "Yes," said Ford, "but..." "Well, what happened, you see, was," said the captain, "our planet, the world from which we have come, was, so to speak, doomed."
"Doomed?"
"Oh, yes. So what everyone thought was, let's pack the whole population into some giant spaceships and go and settle on another planet." Having told this much of his story, he settled back with a satisfied grunt.
"You mean a less doomed one," prompted Arthur.
"What did you say, dear fellow?"
"A less doomed planet you were going to settle on."
"Are going to settle on, yes. So it was decided to build three ships, you see, three arcs in space, and..." "I'm not boring you, am I?"
"No, no," said Ford firmly. "It's fascinating."
"You know, it's delightful," reflected the captain, "to have someone else to talk to for a change."
Number two's eyes darted feverishly about the room again, and then settled back on the mirror like a pair of flies briefly distracted from their favourite piece of month-old meat.
"Trouble with a long journey like this," continued the captain, "is that you end up just talking to yourself a lot, which gets terribly boring because half the time you know what you're going to say next."
"Only half the time?" asked Arthur in surprise. The captain thought for a moment.
"Yes, about half, I'd say. Anyway, where's the soap?"
He fished around and found it.
"Yes, so anyway," he resumed, "the idea was that into the first ship, the A ship, would go all the brilliant leaders, the scientists, the great artists, you know, all the achievers, and then into the third, or C ship, would go all the people who did the actual work, who made things and did things, and then into the B ship, that's us, would go everyone else, the middlemen, you see." He smiled happily at them. "And we were sent off first," he concluded, and hummed a little bathing tune.
The little bathing tune, which had been composed for him by one of the world's most exciting and prolific jingle writers, who was currently asleep in Hold 36, some 900 yards behind them, covered what would otherwise have been an awkward moment of silence. Ford and Arthur shuffled their feet and furiously avoided each other's eyes.
Said Arthur after a moment, "what exactly was it that was wrong with your planet, then?"
"Oh, it was doomed, as I said," said the captain. "Apparently it was going to crash into the sun or something, or maybe it was that the moon was going to crash into us, something of the kind, absolutely terrifying prospect, whatever it was."
"Oh," said the first officer suddenly, "I thought it was that the planet was going to be invaded by a gigantic swarm of 12-foot piranha bees. Wasn't that it?"
Number two spun round, eyes ablaze with a cold, hard light that only comes with the amount of practice he was prepared to put in.
"That's not what I was told," he hissed. "My commanding officer told me the entire planet was in imminent danger of being eaten by an enormous mutant star goat."
"Oh, really?" said Ford Prefect.
"Yes, a monstrous creature from the pit of hell with scything teeth 10,000 miles long, breath that would boil oceans, claws that would tear continents from their roots, 1,000 eyes that burned like the sun, slavering jaws 1,000,000 miles across, a monster such you see you have never, never, ever..."
"And they made sure that they sent you lot off first, did they?" inquired Arthur.
"Oh, yes," said the captain. "Well, everyone said, very nicely, I thought, that it was very important for morale to feel that they would be arriving on a planet where they could be sure of a good haircut and where the phones were clean."
"Oh, yes," agreed Ford. "I can see that would be very important. And the other ships, they followed on after you, did they?"
For a moment, the captain did not answer. He twisted round in his bath and gazed backwards over the huge bulk of the ship towards the bright galactic centre. He squinted into the inconceivable distance.
"Ah, well, it's funny you should say that," he said, and allowed himself a slight frown at Ford Prefect,
"because, curiously enough, we haven't heard a peep out of them since we left 5 years ago. But they must be behind us somewhere."
He peered off into the distance again. Ford peered with him and gave a thoughtful frown.
"Unless, of course," he said softly, "they were eaten by the goat."
"Ah, yes," said the captain, with a slight hesitancy creeping into his voice. "The goat." His eyes passed over the solid shapes of the instruments and computers that lined the bridge. They winked away innocently at him. He stared out at the stars, but none of them said a word. He glanced at his first and second officers, but they seemed also lost in their own thoughts for a moment. He glanced at Ford Prefect, who raised his eyebrows at him.
"It's a funny thing, you know," said the captain at last. "But now that I actually come to tell the story to someone else, I mean, does it strike you as odd, Number One?" Said Number One. "Well," said Ford, "I can see that you've got a lot of things you're going to want to talk about, so thanks for the drink, and if you could sort of drop us off at the nearest convenient planet." "Ah, well, that's a little difficult, you see," said the captain, "because our trajectory thingy was preset before we left Golga Frensham. I think partly because I'm not very good with figures." "You mean we're stuck here on the ship?" exclaimed Ford, suddenly losing patience with the whole charade. "When are you meant to be reaching this planet you're meant to be colonising?" "Oh, we're nearly there, I think," said the captain. "Any second now. It's probably time I was getting out of the bath, in fact. Oh, I don't know, though. Why stop just when I'm enjoying it?" "So we're actually going to land in a minute," said Arthur. "Well, not so much land, in fact. Not actually land as such. No, what are you talking about?" asked Ford sharply. "Well," said the captain, picking his way through the words carefully, "I think, as far as I remember, we were programmed to crash on it." "Crash!" shouted Ford and Arthur. Yes, said the captain. "Yes, it's all part of the plan, I think. There was a terribly good reason for it, which I can't quite remember at the moment. It was something to do with a..." Ford exploded. "You're a load of useless bloody loonies!" he shouted. "Ah, yes, that was it," beamed the captain. "That was the reason."